Today's guest on the podcast is author Emily Giffen. Love her. You guys may know her as the author of the amazing Chick Lit novel. I don't even know if they call it that, but Emily called it that in the podcast, so I think it's fair game. But the book Something Borrowed, which later was turned into a movie with Kate Hudson and John Krasinski and Jennifer Goodwin, but she's the best-selling author of 9 books, and I believe she's working on her 10th published book that'll be coming out, which we're not really sure yet. But I enjoyed this episode. It was a lot different than many of my other interviews because she really took the time to kind of tell her story and how she works on her books and had a lot of really great advice for aspiring writers and those who want to be a writer. So I loved her just candid advice and storytelling ability. We just had a great time. She's definitely one of my heroes, and it was pretty surreal to get to talk to her on this podcast. So I hope you all enjoy this episode with best-selling author Emily Giffen.
Welcome to the Same 24 Hours podcast with Meredith Atwood. We all have the same 24 hours each day, and it's what we do with those hours that makes all the difference between our health, happiness, and success.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Same 24 Hours podcast. I'm your host, Meredith Atwood. Today's guest is one of my favorite authors. Emily Giffen is here. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Meredith. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, I'm so excited. So your book, Something Borrowed, I had a friend in law school give me, and I fell in love with it, as I'm sure many people have said, but you and I have a lot more in common than I ever knew. I mean, I don't have all these best-selling books, but we have a lot in common.
Yes, well, I don't have a podcast, so.
Together we're like a superhuman.
I think it's safe to say we probably shared a disdain for the practice of law. Is that fair?
Yes, and you're also a recovering attorney, which I like to call myself.
Yes, that's true. Now, I liked law school, though. Did you enjoy the actual 3 years of law school?
You know, I just felt like I was a fraud. I always tell the story that on the first day of civil procedure, I sat there and they started talking about Penoyer v. Neff and then some other case. Yeah. And I thought, what is civil procedure and what am I doing here? Like, I had no idea what that even meant.
CivPro, as you know, remember they called it CivPro.
CivPro.
That was, I thought, the hardest first year class. It doesn't seem like it should be because it's just like procedural. But I thought, like, I think it's right. You grow up understanding what a tort is, you know, negligence and criminal law and even the Constitution. But when it came to civil procedure, I had trouble with that, too. Now that we're putting everyone to sleep with our law school chat.
No, all the lawyers are nodding.
I actually loved law school. I went to Virginia, which I think was more laid back than some law schools. And I especially loved my constitutional law class and learning. But I think I was sort of avoiding the real world by going from college to law school. And then when I got into, you know, the practice of law at my big law firm, that was when I felt the way you did, like a complete fraud. I'm like, okay, I'll learn how to work the phone systems, but please don't give me an assignment after that.
Oh my gosh. When you say constitutional law, I have to laugh because I had a con law professor who was notorious for the Socratic method. And I was just horrified. I just wanted everyone to not look at me in law school. And he would, you know, call on us and I had to stand up. And he, in one class, called me, my last name is Atwood. He called me Miss Asswood by mistake. 2 times.
Now, do you think it was by mistake?
It was totally by mistake because this guy, he was like unbreakable. And then his face was so red. He's like, oh, my apologies. I didn't. But then he went and did it again.
So I had my torts professor was the same, like huge on Socratic method, but kind of, you know, mean spirit. In fact, there's a scene in Something Borrowed that's like based loosely on him, but that's the kind of thing he might have even done on purpose.
No, he didn't.
He would stay with you for like 2, you know, if he called on you and you didn't perform that day, he would stay with you that whole hour and all the next day. It was brutal, but.
I know this guy didn't mean to say asswood because I was very big at the time. I was like 250 pounds and like that would have just been really bad.
That's just another layer of rude, probably. Right. I'm sure he didn't even notice that. Those law school professors are just totally focused on
oh my God.
From the law.
Well, but I'm glad you enjoyed law school. I just felt like from the start, I didn't fit in. I mean, like you, I wanted to be a writer, and I kind of took a detour. How did that happen for you? Because you said even when you were a little kid, you wanted to be a writer.
Right, right. You know, it's funny when you talk to doctors, for example, just to use them as an example of like, you know, school, you go to school for several years to become a doctor. You hardly ever hear any of them say, well, I used to be a doctor, but now I'm doing X, Y, and Z. It's like you go to med school and you're a doctor, and that's usually what you do. And with lawyers, it's just not like that. And my theory is that I think a lot of people who are just strong in the liberal arts and have no idea what they want to do, just go to law school as a default. It's like, okay, well, I'll take the LSAT. And, you know, I'm a history major, an English major, a French major, and I'm not really sure what I want to do. So I'll take the LSAT and I'll just go to law school. And I think that was for me the case, because I did know that I wanted to be a writer ever since I was, you know, really young. And that was sort of my track in high school. It was kind of a nerd in high school. I was like on the creative writing club. I was the editor in chief of the newspaper. I wrote in my journal. I don't think I skipped a day in my journal, not skip a day for, you know, from the fifth grade through law school, which I think speaks more to my OCD than you know, my love of writing. But I did love to write, and I just, there's always something I wanted to do. But I think I panicked around junior year of college and thought, well, I don't really want to be a reporter. And, you know, I'm not really sure, you know, I can't just graduate and start writing creatively. And so why don't I have to be practical. So I'll go to law school.
That's just what happened to me. I panicked. Yeah. I panicked second year because someone told me that I was going to be poor. And being like poor was like one of my fear sets. Like I didn't want to not ever have enough to eat.
Right,
that's when I changed, because I was a journalism major.
You don't want to be poor. You don't want to do the ramen noodle thing forever. But then you fall into the trap. I don't know what you did when you graduated from law school, but you know, I went to Virginia, it's a top law school, we're recruited by all the top firms. And so I'm like, okay, well, I'll take the job that pays the most. I'll go to this big law firm. And I think that's really, depending on how you look at it, it's either what screwed me in that path, in that profession, or it's what ultimately saved me. Because I think if I had done something else, like in, worked for a not-for-profit or gone into become a DA, I think that I would have probably stuck with the law, in which case I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have left to write. So that's, I guess that's a positive way of looking at it.
Right.
But yeah, I think misery can be very motivating. And at my large law firm, I was in the litigation department, and I was doing, you know, these endlessly long document reviews for General Electric and Philip Morris. So basically, you know, one case was about a company that had polluted our nation's rivers, and they were working on remediation. And in the other case, of course, Philip Morris, it's tobacco litigation. So you're deposing, you know, people dying of lung cancer. So it's like particularly dreary, grim, several years. But I had, I don't know if you had loans, but I had, you know, $100,000 worth of loans or whatever. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to live like I'm making like nothing. I'm going to live like I'm, you know, a first grade teacher in Manhattan, even though I'm getting this pretty good salary, and spend it all on paying back my loans. So I was able to pay them back in about 5 years. And that was my like ticket to freedom. And I just left after that.
And so when did you write? You wrote your first novel while you were practicing, right?
Yes, I did. So that's sort of a misleading. Sometimes people look at the timeline and say like, oh, I quit my job and then I went to write Something Borrowed and it got published and I, you know, never looked back. And that's, you know, that's true. And I was lucky that it happened after I quit the law, because I was sort of giving myself a 1 year deadline to write, but it was my second effort. So the first novel that I wrote, you know, of course I wrote my whole life, but sort of the first official novel that I wrote and then submitted to an agent and, you know, got an agent on was this book that I wrote the first 5 years of while I was practicing law. So I would write at night and on the weekends and sometimes while I was billing General Electric, but it was a flat rate. So I wasn't, you know, technically, you know, doing anything too awful, but, so I wrote it in the 5 years and then got an agent. And then ultimately it was, it was, you know, rejected. And this all around the time of 9/11. So it was just a crazy time to make a change, to leave New York, to make the decision to, I was turning 30. So that I think played into it as well. You know, I think sometimes we make decisions. It's easier to make decisions when we're approaching a big benchmark, or it's maybe not easier, but it motivates us because we're thinking, okay, I'm turning 30, you know, what am I doing? Or which is absurd now. It feels absurd now because I think 30 is so young, but that's what it took for me. And I think it's different for a lot of people. It's like, sometimes it's turning 40 or 50, or it's getting married, or it's getting divorced, or it's, you know, some kind of, or a high school reunion coming up. But I think sometimes we feel extra motivated to say, okay, what, you know, take stock of your life and just sit back and ask yourself, is this the life that I'm, you know, meant to be living? Am I being true to myself? Did I make these decisions for myself, or did I make them, you know, with others in mind, or because I wanted to appear to be successful, or because I wanted, you know, to check the boxes? And so that was the time in my life when I, you know, reevaluated a lot of things and took the plunge to write another book.
Well, how did you have the fortitude after that first book was rejected? Like, what was the process of the rejection, and how long did you kind of pursue that particular book before you said, well, I got to put that one aside and write another one?
I think the way it happened was, you know, is that I finished the first one. I got an agent very quickly. You know, we got two or three rejection letters, and then I didn't hear from my agent for a while. And so I'd already made this decision that if it worked out, great. And if it didn't work out, all the more reason that I needed to step away from these like hours that were becoming more grueling, you know, the more senior that I got. And I still was like not doing work of any import. I wasn't trying cases or anything, but you know, I was given more responsibility as I like climbed in the ranks at my law firm. And so I quit and said to myself, I will return in a year and give myself 1 year to write another book. And so then I ended up, once I started the new book, after I began it, I ultimately heard from the final few publishers. And my agent, actually, I share this story just to inspire, you know, other writers who might be facing those rejection letters and the very difficult process and ego crushing process of trying to get published. But I could not even get my agent at the time, to write back, you know. So I'd write her a letter. I wouldn't hear anything back from her. And finally I wrote, I remember this was at the start of 2002. So I had been writing this second novel, Something Borrowed, for several months. And I wrote to her and said, you know, dear, probably shouldn't say her name, but I understand that the news is not favorable, or, you know, that we probably don't have good news, but I would love to have closure on this submission and a release from our contract as I write another book. You know, and I said something like, you know, could you just please let me know? And she wrote basically something along the lines of, they all rejected it and you're released. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, you know, I mean, you ideally want the agent that holds your hand and tells you you're wonderful and their loss and everything else. But I really actually didn't need that. At the time, I just sort of wanted a sense of like civility, and she didn't give it to me. So that was actually really kind of motivating, because I'm like, okay, now I have. And then there was this law partner that made my life rather miserable. And when I quit, I remember taking my final box, you know, been taking things out of my office for a couple.
Right. And it's like my slow withdrawal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, okay, maybe I need this copy of this file in case, you know, because I'll probably have to be a lawyer again. And, you know, like the framed pictures of my then boyfriend, whatever they were. So I'm taking these things out of my office, and he stops me, like as I'm getting on the elevator, like my final, like, you know, departure from, and he looks at me, and he knew I was leaving because the cases had been transferred, and he knew, but he sort of pretended like he forgot. He said, oh yeah, you're leaving to write that book, right? And I said, yeah. And he goes, everyone's writing one. And and then he gave me the two finger, like, you know, gun holster thing, like the two gun with his fingers, and he goes, good luck with that, like right as the elevator doors close. And I'm like, okay, I have his face telling me good luck with that with the double holster gun. And I have the agent who said they all rejected it and you're released from the contract. I have those two people in my mind that were sort of additional motivation in addition to like all the positive parts of like, I'm doing what I love. My mother's she's now retired, but she was a practicing librarian at the time who was so incredibly encouraging. So, you know, I had the positive encouragement and then I had that sort of negative additional stuff that can sometimes really get you over the finish line. I like thinking of it, you know, often when someone asks that question, they, you know, they give me a lot of credit for resiliency and bravery and everything else. And I definitely think that writing after you've been rejected or, you know, while you're going through that process requires some amount of grit and some amount of faith in yourself. I guess bravery that like, even if you fail, you're, you know, you're going to be okay. Like you don't really care that others will know you fail. So I think there's a certain bit of credit that I deserve, but really, I don't think I deserve it in the way that I would if I had been just happy enough. Like, in other words, I was so miserable as a lawyer. It's sort of like the person who's boyfriend cheats on them 7 times and they finally like leave. Like, yeah. Did they deserve credit or should they have done it all along? Is it has the relationship where the guy is like really pretty nice and it's pretty solid and things are good enough? Those are the people that I think really deserve credit for being brave when they step away from a situation that's just okay. And I did not feel like life was okay as a lawyer in life building in New York City, for sure.
So you wrote Something Borrowed within your time frame, and how quickly?
It was about, I remember I moved to London on September 16th, 2001. So it was actually one of the very first flights they let out of JFK after 9/11. And I turned in my manuscript to a new agent in around Thanksgiving the following year. So it was, I guess, 13 months. So it was a little over, but, you know, things happened pretty quickly after that. They got, you know, this agent signed me up right away and she submitted. And you know, we had a few offers, you know, very, very modest little offers, not some crazy bidding war or anything, but you know, definite offers. I remember we had two and, they were both low, but one was for hardcover, which was even lower. And the other one was for paperback. And I remember my mother saying like, go with the hardcover because she's, you know, she's a librarian and she wanted to see the book in it. I went with that one and it didn't matter that it was for nothing. It just was such a thrill that it was actually going to be published. And I always say that it was the happiest day of my life. And I feel bad because I have 3 kids. They're beautiful and healthy. And, you know, I had twins that were born on New Year's Eve a few years later. And then I had a daughter.
I have a New Year's Eve baby, too. You,
oh, my gosh. That's crazy. A boy or a girl?
A girl.
Oh, wow. Wait. Year?
2008. She's
okay. Yeah. So that my boys were turning 5. In fact, they turned 5 and we took them to London. So we were in London celebrating their first birthday when your daughter was born. I love that.
Oh,
that connection.
There's a lot here.
Legal careers. But so, yeah, I mean, and I love my husband. We had a lovely wedding. But that's, you know how weddings are. They're stressful. It rained that day. Things went wrong. I'm worried about how I look. But that phone call saying, like, you're going to be published is just, it was just sheer joy with no corresponding pain or stress. So I still say that's my favorite day, much to the, you know, irritation of my husband and 3 children.
Right, right. Well, how quickly? I mean, it became a bestseller fairly quickly.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's typically, it's usually your first week or, you know, because it falls after that, right? Because you have the pre-sale. So it made the extended list, which is, I guess it's still considered a bestseller. Is that right? I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe it was like 15th or something, but it was in the teens. And again, it was, you know, I was absolutely thrilled. That's probably my second favorite day. and then the birth of my children.
Right.
But I think a lot of that credit belongs with my publisher, which at the time was St. Martin's Press, and my editor, Jennifer Enderlin, who's fabulous. And she publishes Kristen Hannah now and so many other bestsellers. And she just really, I mean, because again, and I tell a lot of writers this who haven't been published or working towards getting published, it's not a question of the best books get published or the best books reach bestseller status. It's just, you know, it's just not. It's there's so much luck. There's so much subjectivity when you submit your manuscript. You know, my story, Something Borrowed, was about a girl who falls in love with her best friend's fiance. So let's say that Jennifer Enderlin had read that book and her best friend had just betrayed her like 2 weeks before.
Yeah, you know, you're not getting published.
Or if she had just published a book that was very similar. And, you know, before I went down this road, this publishing journey, I used to think that it was a very, you know, fair and equitable and objective thing where everyone in the publishing house read it, or at least like a committee of 10, and they all sort of voted on like, is this person a good writer? And it's really nothing like that. So if my agent had submitted this same manuscript to a different editor and how, you know, typically they'll just reject it. They don't necessarily pass it along to somebody else in house. And so it's just, you see how much luck is involved. And I can even take it one step farther than that when, which I wasn't able to see until years later when I read, and I always forget his titles, but one of Malcolm Gladwell's books about, you know, how important the timing of what you're doing is. And I realized, again, I can never keep this up. All, but I can't ever keep what theory belongs in which book, but it basically says that, you know, like if you're going to be a software, you know, all the software geniuses were all born in sort of like the late 50s, I think it is. And, you know, that it's like if Steve Jobs had been born a little bit earlier, the technology wouldn't have been where it was and he would have been in a different profession. And if he had been born a little later, then someone else would have been doing what he was doing and he would have been too late for it. And the way that I see myself fitting into that same analysis is, you know, I wrote a book about a girl falling in love with her best friend's fiance as this so-called, you know, genre of chick lit was exploding. And the book fell within those parameters. It's in a big city. It's written in the first person. It deals, you know, largely with the relationship driven issues. And, you know, right before that, we had Bridget Jones' Diary and we had and Jane Green's books were out and they were looking to publish these books. So imagine if I had written Something Borrowed 5 years earlier before Bridget Jones' Diary, they might have passed on it. And if I had written it 5 years later, as many wonderful novels surely were written in this vein, when the genre was less hot, then they were probably passed on. So I really, you know, yes, I had to have grit. I had to keep writing. I had to keep trying. And I do deserve some credit for that. There's an enormous component of luck involved with it. And then similarly, the luck that it was just published right, you know, that it, can you imagine if you had a novel that came out around on 9/11, you know, on 9/11, or if you something else big was happening, you know, like say Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton, and it just was like it didn't get attention, and you got dropped from the news, or let's say that the publisher picked a terrible cover and the cover didn't work. You know, I remember the buyer for Barnes & Noble, Cecily Hensley, didn't like butterflies. Let's say that, and she didn't like to buy a lot of books with butterflies on them. I think that was a rumor that I heard. I don't know. But let's say you had a butterfly on your cover and she didn't want to buy as many copies. There's just so much that goes into it. So I share that to encourage those who have had less favorable results, to remind them that so much of life is luck, and say, you have to create your own luck by continuing to persist and work hard. But the stars aligned the second time around for me. And you know, I just got very lucky with all of it. It all came together. We had a great cover. We had a quote from Lauren Weisberger, which I am friends with her to this day. And I remain so grateful. In fact, I blurbed a recent book of hers and she was like, thank you so much. And I'm like, are you kidding? I can never make up for the fact that you have on the cover of my book, Something Borrowed, like, I loved it, by the author of Devil Wears Prada. Right. In terms of people picking it up, oh, Devil Wears Prada author liked it, like, I'll buy this. So, yeah, I got very lucky.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you have those people in your life who, they are so, you know, epic. And they're just, like you, for example, you coming on my podcast to me is like such a big favor. And
are you kidding? You're a huge
fan. Oh, I love you. Seriously, but yeah, I mean, I've had a few. I had a book come out 2 weeks ago, published, and then I've got one coming out at the end of December. And it's exactly as you said. Mine are in the sports and then self-help genres, which you don't have to write the whole thing before you submit it. But just the connection that I had, a friend connect me to her agent, who connected me to this editor, who then they all promptly forgot about it. And then a year later, the editor and the agent were having lunch, and the editor said, I wish I had done something with that triathlon girl. And then they reconnected with me, and then everything, that not only did they buy my triathlon book, but they wanted a new book. And it was just all those things just lined up. Yeah.
I mean, but it's also that your book was great, you know, and it's that your story's great, which is so, it's so inspiring. So I think, you know, there's that too, but you like I do recognize that some of it's just the way things align.
Yeah. I mean, in the background, I was still beating my head against the wall, just like you were.
Of course.
But you have to beat your head against the wall and hope the stars align.
Yeah, exactly. You have to do both. Yeah. But congratulations on your second. I didn't know about the second one.
It's coming out in December. So
that's awesome. What title? So I can write it down.
It's called The Year of No Nonsense.
Oh, I love that.
How a Little Less Bullshit Will Change Your Life.
I love that. That's very you. That's awesome. I love that.
And it's very trendy to cuss in your titles right now, which I have. Yeah. I had to like kind of hold back on that, but my editor was like, it's fine. And I'm like, my mother is not going to be proud of this. But it's, you know, the whole thing, I have a whole chapter on people pleasing and how to get over people pleasing. And really the only reason I would not cuss in the book or in the title is because I don't want people to be disappointed in me. And so by cussing on the title, I'm like actually, you know, taking a stand against my people pleasing. So it's all tied in there, but yeah, I'm excited about it.
I love that. That makes so much sense. And that's such an evolution though, don't you think?
Oh yeah. Oh gosh.
As you get older. It also was very important in writing fiction to, I think Stephen King calls it like writing with the door closed. You know, if I'm writing, and my sex scenes are very sort of 13. I mean, maybe R occasionally, but not really. This last one was a little more R. But I'll write something and I'm like, oh, I don't want to write that. My dad's going to read this. I remember he read Something Borrowed. He said, well, no wonder, he said to me, no wonder you've lost so many wallet in New York City cabs. Like, and I do think that like I had lost in the course of 5 years, I lost like 2 or 3 wallets. And he said, no, well, no wonder all the drinking you're doing. And I'm like, well, Dad, first of all, although granted I was, you know, in my 20s in New York and I was doing some drinking, I'm like, Dad, it's fiction. I'm not Rachel. You know, like this is, you know, you have to separate it, but you know, you know that he's thinking that. So that'll enter into your head, and you really can't live your life that way, or you can't, you know, write fiction that way, or nonfiction in your case.
Well, and I keep thinking I really should have just started with fiction, because I am like really putting it all out there. With a nonfiction like memoir type self-help, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it would have been so much better to just make up characters, because at least there would have been doubt.
that's so brave, and it's fantastic, and you have a really good story to tell. So that's, I mean, that makes total sense, and you can do fiction this time around.
Yeah, I kind of want to, but I don't know. I kind of have a roadblock. Like, how do you write fiction? I mean, how do you create your characters? I mean, I've read and read and read my whole life. I read a ton of fiction, and I guess you just do it, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, I would ask the same thing about running, you know, doing triathlons. And I think the answer really is interestingly kind of the same. It's sort of like, well, you just have to start. Mm-hmm. And you know this from writing your books, but I think people are intimidated with the idea of writing a book, period. But maybe especially even fiction, because it's like, where do you start? But if you just view it as like the way you would train for a marathon or triathlon, like, okay, I got to get out there run today or swim today. You know, you just start and then you build from that. So, you know, every single time I say this, and yet every single time, this is my 10th novel that I'm probably 30% of the way into, actually 20%, but in case my editor's listening, 30%. but it's, you know, so it's my 10th published novel and my 11th, if you include the one that, quote, they all rejected. But every single time I just deal with this total fear of like, I won't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is crazy, but I have it right here from 4:18 a.m. Okay. I'm going to read you this. This is like, I can't even remember exactly what's in it, but my best friend from like the third grade, his name is Doug, asked me like how it was going, and I said it's miserable, and he said something like, he just basically said, don't you know, just do your thing, and da, 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 da. So then I wrote, here's the thing, I never, and he goes, you'll get your swagger. I said, here's the thing, I never have swagger. I'm always miserable and panicked and depressed when I write with every single book, not so much that it will suck, although there's that too, but that I just can't do it. I stare at a blank page for most of my life. It's what makes it paralyzing sometimes to even write back to your text. That's kind of like me justifying that I'm a bad text returner, but it's true. It's like I haven't written one decent sentence all day. How dare I get up to work out or write a friend back or enjoy life? It's a cycle of self-loathing and panic. My agent and editor tell me it's normal that all writers are neurotic and semi-miserable. My agent says her other clients is way worse than I am, so I probably shouldn't be sharing that. But I said, I've slept 3 hours tonight. That's a good night. Anyway, that's a lot of self-pity in a text. But
so true. I mean, I go through the same thing, and my editor, Renee, I mean, I told her, well, we were really battling over subtitle, like on this last book. And I told her, I said, it should just be called The Year of No Nonsense, a total dog shit book. Because that's where I was. And she's like, well, that's great. Let's not use that one.
Yeah, let's not. Although, you know what? People would pick it up. It's like there's a certain honesty there. But no, but I share that because I don't. Again, you know, I might sound like a broken record, but I really want to inspire other writers out there. Like I don't think it gets any easier. I think when you're doing something that's hard, like, and like marathon, triathlon, writing a book, or especially when you're putting yourself out there in some way, I think it's, you know, you have to just do it, so to speak. Like, it's scary every single time, and it doesn't get easier, and you just have to kind of do it. And there is a point for me in writing a novel that's, I'm very nearly there. I'm not quite there, because it usually does happen around the third to halfway point where it, you know, when I'm feeling really positive, I like to call it like the magic kicks in, but it's not quite magic really. It's just this feeling that it's not quite as hard, that mm-hmm. you're not staring at the blank page quite so much, that things are flowing a little bit, and that you feel that the characters are real in your mind. Enough. I mean, of course, you know, they're fictional, but they feel real enough or fully formed enough that it's almost like, you know, what they would do in a situation, and you're not trying to like, you're not so much of a marionette. Wait, is the marionette the person that controls it?
The one standing over the puppet.
The puppeteer. Let's just say that. Like,
oh yeah. Wait, not much now I'm confused. What's a marionette?
I feel like a marionette is.
I think it is the puppet.
Yeah, it is the puppet.
You're right.
Yeah. But whatever, the puppeteer. Instead of the, you know, that I'm more like writing about these like fully formed people. And then it gets fun for a minute in time until it's not fun again when you're writing the ending. But, you know, it's a weird thing because I sound like I hate it, but, you know, it's almost like you love it and hate it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that how it is with the triathlon, or is that just like sheer love?
I mean, no, I feel the same way. I mean, the way that the triathlon book, I wrote it in 2011, and then this was the second edition we just put out. But with this other book, like, I wrote the proposal, and it was going to be this like fun, loving, like happy, like self-help kind of fun thing. And then it just turned, like, it took a sharp detour for the dark when I actually like got down to what it really meant. And so then I was like, oh my gosh, I hate myself and this book and the world. And why did I ever embark on it? And it's going to help no one. And it, you know, it went down that path. And then like, I just kept beating my head against the wall. And then the light came in. I was like, this is my purpose. This is what I'm, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then, you know, when it was due, it was a dog shit novel, you know, dog shit book. And so, I mean, it's just up and down.
It is. Yeah. And maybe that's, you know, if we step back from it, maybe that's a metaphor, you know, for life. Like, yeah. It's, life is hard and it can be really tragic and difficult and unsatisfying and full of disappointments and full of mistakes and, you know, missteps. And, you know, you tend to, it's like themes that I write about are often that you tend to hurt the people you love the most. It's just sort of the nature of life, because if you have to sort of, they have to be emotionally invested for you to be able to hurt them. And so that your big mistakes in life are typically, you know, the ones that hurt people that you love the most. And the times that you're hurt tend to be from the people who love you the most. And it's just sort of the nature of life. And that's, you know, those are the themes that I like to write about a lot. But so it sort of mirrors that. I mean, if it were easy, it wouldn't mean much. You know, there's the meaning comes from that difficult journey. And I think that's like life.
And parenting, right? I mean, talk about hard and meaning something, right?
Or talk about your mistakes that, like, you can play all the time. Like, oh my gosh, how could I have handled that like this? Or her sleeping issues a result of, you know, my poor parenting decisions when she was 2 and a half, or, you know, whatever. But it's really true. It's hard. But I think the trick is to just be very honest with yourself, and continue to try to, like, make those improvements, and also not be too hard on yourself. Like, be able to forgive yourself, and or to be able to say, okay, this book isn't dog shit. This chapter's dog shit, but the whole book is dog shit.
Now, are you still living in Atlanta?
I am.
We just moved from Atlanta in January. We were there for better part of 10 years.
Oh, darn.
So funny. So which part?
So we live in Buckhead. We moved here to this neighborhood when, at the time, my husband was working a little north and the commute was easy. And he left his job, I think, around 2010 or 11, and was a stay-at-home dad for, like, 5 years before he kind of went back to it, which was great, like, such a gift for everyone, for the kids most of all, I think, to have those years with him being so present.
And yeah, I worked in Buckhead when at my law firm on Piedmont near Lenox.
Oh, which
one's? I'll tell you offline.
I could tell mine. Winston and Strawn. No, I love the people at most of the people, except for that one law partner.
And, I mean, that's the reason I stayed as long as I did, was because I love the people I worked for. Yeah, because I practiced for almost 13 years, so I didn't get out quite as soon as you did.
Right.
It all worked out. I mean, part of me staying a lawyer allowed me to have a story to tell, I guess, and so that it all works out, like you say. It's good.
I mean, I think that's very true. If I had not, you know, gone to, I don't think I would have moved to New York City without having that job lined up, you know, at a law firm. I think I would have been too intimidated. And so, you know, or worried about, as you said, like, worried about, like, being able to make it financially, pay the bills, or, you know, pay rent or whatever. So, I mean, I think at the very least, working as a lawyer gave me that, like, the gift of having lived in New York City. And it's like your relationships. Like, one of my very best friends had her office next to me. We still talk all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I still go to my law firm reunions. I go to my law firm reunions, not my law school reunions. Even though it's like, I hated being a lawyer, but I loved that, you know, it was just great. It was it had some Ally McBeal moments to it, for sure, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, when you go to your reunion, do you get to see Double Pistol Partner?
Okay. I'm going to have to tell you this story. I restrain myself from sharing it when I first told you, but since you're directly asking, he died of a heart attack at the law firm gym. No, that's okay. I'll stop there. I mean, I should say that's okay. It's very sad that he died. Okay, let me just stop. I'll tell you another story later when we're not on. But yeah.
Goodness. You're working on your 11th book. Oh, let's talk about the rejected book. Like, is it not salvageable? That just seems like so much effort.
Yeah, considering that it was, you know, written over the course of 5 years, it is a lot of effort. It's, you know, I have it here. I have it, like, I'm actually sitting up in my third floor little attic office. Like, I have a desk up here. And I can see about 10 feet away is the box where the manuscript is. That's like in funny. With a lot of other things. But what one thing I would say about it is I think that it wasn't published for a reason. I could probably clean it up and maybe try to submit it again. It's young adult, and I write women's fiction now, so it would be a different genre, which I guess that would be okay. But there's something about it that I love, the fact that it was never held up to sort of the scrutiny of readers. I mean, I love sharing my stories with readers, but the minute you share them, they're not entirely your own. It would pain me for this book to be criticized in a way that, like, all the other books that I've written, it's like, oh, okay, well, some will like it, some won't like it. I don't know. It's a strange feeling, but maybe one day, maybe under a pseudonym of some kind.
That's right. Young adult is so hot right now, though.
It is. Yeah, that's true.
So what was it like to have your book made into a movie? The movie came out, let's see, Something Borrowed, was it 2011 with Kate Hudson and Jennifer Goodwin?
Yes.
What was that like?
It was surreal. It happened so gradually because the book optioned by one producer and nothing had been done with it. And then it was optioned by a second producer and nothing was done with it. And then the third one came along, and she was actually, her name is Molly Smith. She's a great friend of mine. She works for Black Label Media. Well, she runs Black Label Media. That's her company. But she was filming at the time The Blind Side in Atlanta. And we met for dinner, and she said that she had contacted the producers who had optioned Something Borrowed for the second time around, and she contacted them, and she wanted to partner with them, and what did I think? So at this point I'm like, okay, probably nothing's going to happen for the third time. But I really liked her. We sort of hit it off, and I was excited about the faint possibility that it could happen, and it did, and it was great. I think film, I loved it. I mean, I think that they did a really good job of staying true to the characters. I think John Krasinski was wonderful as Ethan. Kate Hudson was great as Darcy. I loved having a cameo in it. It was so much fun.
I went to law school with John Krasinski's cousin. Brother.
Oh, really?
Cousin. Yeah. And it was at the time when The Office was just kind of hitting off.
Oh, wow.
And so my classmate was like, yeah, my cousin's in the show. It's like premiering on Wednesday or something. We were watching it. And I mean, it's so funny now. Like, he's a megastar.
That's crazy. That's so cool.
I should call him.
You really should. You should.
Hey, remember your cousin? We all watched his show and helped his ratings. I want to talk to that guy.
Give me an autograph. Give me some movie premiere tickets.
But yeah, I love that movie. And I, it's funny when you read the book and then you see the movie, usually you feel strongly one way or another, but I'm with you. I think they did an excellent job.
Yeah, I think they really did. I mean, there was a couple things that I would have done differently, which, Molly knows, which of course is going to happen. Notably, I think that I didn't like about, this is such a minor criticism, but that Ethan and the John Krasinski played and the main character were only friends in the book. And in the film, like, there's a third act moment where he says, like, maybe he has feelings for her. And I like that integrity of, like, male-female friendships that are only ever friends.
Yeah.
But I also could see that you needed that added drama in the third act. And so, I had no problem with the changes that they made. And I think I love the fact that, like, with a movie, it's so collaborative, and you're so out on a limb and alone when you're writing a novel. It's just like there's no committee, there's no help. That's why I'm envious of the writing partners. When there's two authors, that must be fun. You can be like, well, it didn't do as well because of your chapters. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
Totally kidding. It's just kind of fun to be in it with someone. That's something I do miss about being a lawyer. Like, just that camaraderie and being able to, like, hang out next to the water cooler, so to speak.
Right, for sure. Well, Emily, I have one more question for you.
Okay.
This podcast is called The Same 24 Hours, which means we all have the same 24 hours in our day, but it's what we do with those 24 hours that leads to our greatest health, happiness, and success. So I like to ask my guests, what is something that they do on a daily basis that they think makes a great difference in their 24 hours? So what is something you do every day that you think kind of...
Okay. Well, that's a challenging question. me, given the cycle that I'm in with the book, because I could share a lot of things that I do that aren't particularly helpful. And you, I recommend that you do the opposite. Like, don't get on Twitter the moment you wake up in the morning, and don't get on Twitter in the middle of the night when you. So I could share a lot of those, but I would say one of the habits that I have that I do feel like is constructive is that I do put my phone away for a 3-hour period, sort of when the kids are getting home from school and before, you know, around dinner time and, you know, just in that sort of 6 to 9 period. Mm-hmm. I think it's very helpful to just sort of be focused and have, and I encourage the kids to do the same thing. So I think that's something that I do. I try to remember in the morning I have a gratitude journal that a friend, a very good friend, gave me, and he said, "I know you're not gonna fill this out because no one ever does." He's like, but really, really try to, like, keep it by your bed. He's actually my trainer, but he's also like a really good friend. And I find that when I do that, which I should do more, I probably only do once a week, but it makes such a difference in your focus of positivity. And one other thing I'll share, this doesn't really answer your question, but it's something that's just happening recently, or my boys, and I share it with you because I think you'll find it interesting given your background, but my boys are in the 9th grade. They're huge runners. They're obsessed with cross country. They're currently running like a 450 and 438 mile. Like, they just love it.
Gosh,
so fast. I mean, they're such hard workers, more than natural ability. Hopefully they won't hear me say that. But no, I think it's more important to be a hard worker than to have natural ability. So actually I'd be fine with them saying that, but they work so hard and they have me running. So they gave me this app called Strava, which I don't know.
Yeah, Strava.
Yeah. And so they give me assignments and then they can check and give me kudos. And so I've only been doing it for 2 weeks and I have like 5 runs logged, and I'll caption it saying, "I know this isn't very good and you're probably not that proud, but here's what I did." And they're so sweet and encouraging. And I find that it's the way we have been communicating the best, because it's like, so often we want our kids to do things on our terms. And so I'm sort of entering their world, and they're very vested in it. They'll say like, "No, 8:40 mile isn't," because I had a time trial yesterday. Uh-huh. It was very stressful because I knew they were going to be checking the time. And I'm like, "Okay, I know it's only an 8:40, but there was a lot of pollen out." And they're like, "No." They're like, "How'd you feel?" I'm like, "Oh, I felt miserable. Thank you." But
that's
so that's
awesome.
That I've been doing recently that really I feel it's a great thing to be doing as far as fitness, but also to share that with my kids, with my 9th grade boys, who don't always have a lot to say to me. So
that's awesome. I love that.
That note.
Yeah. Awesome, Emily. Well, thank you so much for your time. I love you, and I love.
Well, same. And I wish you still lived in Atlanta, but maybe our paths will cross.
Yeah.